This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents True Believer, a thriller by Jack Carr. Read by Ray Porter.
For Faith Carr and Emily Wood, for putting up with this crazy adventure, and for those who continue to do the deed at the tip of the spear. Somewhere, a true believer is training to kill you. He is training with minimum food or water, in austere conditions, day and night. The only thing clean on him is his weapon, and he made his web gear. He doesn't worry about what workout to do. His ruck weighs what it weighs. His runs end when the enemy stops chasing him. The true believer doesn't care how hard it is. He only knows that he wins, or he dies. He doesn't go home at 1700. He is home. He knows only the cause. Attributed to an unidentified U.S. Army Special Forces instructor, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, date unknown. Preface. This is a novel of redemption. True Believer explores the psyche of a man who has killed for his country and broken society's most sacred bond in a quest for vengeance. Can this man, who transformed into the very insurgent he'd been fighting, find peace and purpose and learn to live again? These are not unlike the questions facing veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as they prepare to leave military service. Can they find purpose in their lives? Can they identify their next mission? And can it be productive, positive, and inspiring to those around them? The issues surrounding transitioning veterans are numerous and complex. Constant deployments since 9/11, vampire hours overseas, operating at night, grabbing a few precious hours of sleep during daylight, survivor's guilt, born of dead friends and teammates, life-altering physical wounds, traumatic brain injury, and post-traumatic stress. These factors combine with sleep aid dependency, excessive alcohol use, and marital problems to form a caustic cocktail from which it is difficult to recover. For those who have lived their lives in a constant state of hypervigilance, as our DNA dictates is necessary to survive and prevail at the tip of the spear, identifying a new mission in a post-military life can be a daunting task. The team is family. The team is purpose. The team is home. Returning to spouses, children, diapers, soccer practices, and leaky roofs can sometimes pale in comparison to the adrenaline and focus of planning and executing an operation to capture or kill a high-value individual downrange. You've topped off magazines, replaced batteries in NODs, weapons-mounted lights and lasers, gassed up vehicles, studied the target's pattern of life, the target area, and the routes to and from the objective. You've gone over every contingency you can think of. Air assets will be overhead as elements of the Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force observe via a video downlink from a Predator UAV or AC-130 gunship. A quick reaction force is standing by to provide reinforcements if necessary. Your mind is focused. Your team is ready, just waiting for the trigger to execute. You are part of the most experienced, effective, and efficient special operations manhunting machine ever assembled. Replicating that life in the private sector is an exercise in futility. The operator's search for the sensations of the battlefield on the home front can manifest in unproductive and unhealthy endeavors, A new mission with a constructive purpose is necessary. One that fulfills the quest to be a part of something greater than oneself. The old life will always be a part of us, but we need to move forward. Although it certainly informs my writing, I am not a frogman anymore. Instead, I explore the feelings associated with my time in combat on the pages of my political thrillers. It is my hope that those real-world experiences add depth, perspective, and authenticity to the story. Serving my country as a Navy SEAL was something I did. Past tense. I've turned in my M4 and sniper rifle for a laptop and a library as I fulfill my lifelong dream of writing novels. In the pages of True Believer, I examine a similar transition from my protagonist, James Reese. Feeling responsible for the deaths of his family and teammates, betrayed by the country to which he pledged his allegiance and sacred honor, what could possibly give him purpose? What mission could make him want to live again? These issues are the same ones confronting those who have fought in the mountains of the Hindu Kush and along the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates in the cradle of civilization, and, though explored through the medium of a fictional narrative, are no less valid. We are the accumulation of our past experiences. How we channel those experiences and knowledge into wisdom as we move forward is critical. What's Past is Prologue, written by William Shakespeare in The Tempest, is also inscribed on a monument outside of the National Archives in Washington, D.C. How true that is. Jack Carr, Park City, Utah, December 18th, 2018. Though this is a work of fiction, my past profession and its associated security clearances require the True Believer go through a government approval process with the Department of Defense Office of Pre-Publication and Security Review. Their redactions are included as amended and remain in the audiobook. Prologue. London, England, November. Ahmed turned up his collar and cursed the snow. He'd never liked the cold, despite his hometown of Aleppo being a far less temperate destination than most Westerners envisioned. He'd found Italy's Mediterranean coast in the summertime to be a paradise and would have gladly made it his home. His current bosses, however, wanted him in London. Frigid, dreary, snowy London. It was temporary, he was told. 6 months' work with his head down and his mouth shut, and he could live wherever he wanted. His plan was to travel back south, find an honest job, and then send for his family. Tonight, his job was to drive the van. His destination was the medieval market village of Kingston-upon-Thames in southwest London. Ahmed didn't know the nature of his cargo and didn't much care so long as it was unloaded quickly. Whatever he was carrying was heavy. He felt the brakes struggle to handle the load whenever he stopped at the many traffic signals along his route. He turned the white Ford Transit delivery van's heat to its maximum setting and lit a cigarette. Traffic was terrible, even for a Friday evening. Ahmed pulled the cell phone from his pocket. 7:46 p.m. He'd allowed himself plenty of leeway to get to the marketplace on time, but the weather was slowing things down, not to mention the throngs of drivers and pedestrians heading toward what must have been some sort of festival. Children bundled up for the cold, holding hands with parents and siblings, were everywhere. The sight made him think of his own family, crowded into a refugee camp somewhere in Turkey. At least they were no longer in Syria. The van moved at a pedestrian pace as he tapped the horn to part the crowd. He jammed on the brakes and inhaled sharply as a little girl in a pink puffy jacket scurried across the road in his headlights. He turned left and entered the marketplace, stopping the van in front of the address that he'd been given at the garage and turning on the emergency flashers. His eyes strained as he looked through the frosted windows to confirm he was in the right spot, his bosses having been so adamant regarding the precise location of his unloading point. From a bird's-eye view, the marketplace was the shape of a large triangle, wide at one end and narrow at the other. Ahmed's van sat idling at the base end of that triangle, unnoticed by the happy crowds attending the German Christmas market. The shopping district was busy on a normal evening, but with the holiday event in full swing, it was packed. A recent online article had highlighted the quaint festival, and families from all over London and the surrounding suburbs had come to experience its wonders firsthand. Shoppers filled the storefronts, ate in the cafes and pubs, and strolled the booths selling everything from hats and scarves to hot spiced wine, warm pretzels, nutcrackers, candle arches, and traditional wooden ornaments. The already charming town market looked like an alpine village with snow-covered A-frame booths, strung with lights, punctuated by an enormous Christmas tree towering above it all. Ahmed looked around and saw no sign of the men who were to unload the cargo.
"All this congestion must have slowed them down," he thought, as he dialed a number on his phone per his instructions and waited impatiently for an answer.
"Hello. Ana hunak. Antazar."
The line went dead. Ahmed looked at the LCD screen to see whether the call had dropped or if the other caller had simply hung up. He shrugged. The explosion was deafening. The market's snowy cobblestone streets held thousands of shoppers, and those closest to the van were simply vaporized by the detonation. They were the lucky ones. The steel shrapnel that had been embedded directionally into the explosive device raked into the crowd like 1,000 claymore mines, killing, maiming, shredding, and amputating everything in its path, taking future generations before they even existed. A joyful Christmas gathering was now a twisted war zone. Scattered among the wreckage of charred wooden shopping booths, broken glass, tangles of hanging lights and broken tables were scores of the dead and dying. Those who could move and who weren't totally dazed from the shockwave surged toward the apex of the triangular market, rushing to escape the carnage. That end narrowed significantly and was now strewn with the remains of the festival, forced there by the power of the high explosive charge. The debris-choked street was constricted even further by cars parked illegally at the mouth of the triangle. The human wave jammed to a stop in the narrow bottleneck of buildings, cars, and rubble, the panicked mob pushing, shoving, and heaving like stampeding cattle. The young were trampled underneath the old, the weak forsaken by the powerful. The confusing scene was such that, at first, few even noticed the gunfire. Two men wielding Soviet-made PKM belt-fed machine guns opened up on the crowd from the flat third-story rooftops above, one on either side of the bottleneck. Several 7.62 by 54 millimeter R rounds tore through the mass of humanity, shredding bodies in their path. Those below, many already wounded from the van's deadly blast, had no chance for escape. The crowd was packed together so tightly that even the dead did not fall to the ground, but rather were held up like sticks in a bundle by the unrelenting human wave. The shooters had each linked multiple belts of ammunition together to prevent having to reload, and the steel rain fell until each man's belt ran dry. The firing lasted over a minute. The men dropped the empty weapons, barrels glowing white hot from their sustained fire, and made their way down into the chaos below. The market's gutters ran red with blood as they stepped onto what had moments before been a street filled with the joy of the season. Surveillance footage would later show the two men move to opposite ends of the outdoor market and find positions on the street that would be the most likely routes that first responders would take to treat the wounded. Blending in with the dead, they waited more than an hour to detonate the suicide vests strapped to their bodies, murdering police officers, firefighters, medical personnel, and journalists, and creating a new level of terror for 21st century Europe. 440 miles to the southeast, Vasily Andrenov looked at the bank of four giant flat-screen monitors in front of him and admired the turmoil. It was being reported that this was the deadliest terror attack in England's history. Not since the height of the Blitz in 1940 had this many Londoners been killed in a single event. That casualty figures were cresting 300 and expected to climb did not appear to bother him. That half of those killed were children, and that there were not enough trauma centers in all of London to deal with the number of wounded bothered him even less. The room was completely silent. Andrenov preferred it that way. He read the news tickers across the bottom of each screen and sipped his vodka. The media was on the scene before many of the wounded could even be evacuated. Their satellite trucks added to the traffic gridlock and slowed the progress of the steady stream of ambulances dispatched from all over London under the city's emergency response plan. While viewers from around the world watched in shock and horror at what the media quickly termed Britain's 9/11, the Russian's expression never changed, nor did his breathing rate increase or his blood pressure rise. His eyes simply moved from screen to screen, processing information in much the same way the powerful computer on the desk before him processed data. This would not have been overly remarkable except for the fact that Vasily Andrenov was responsible for the carnage in the streets of London that December evening. Shifting his gaze from the spectacle of violence radiating from the wall of his own personal command center down to his computer, Andrenov checked to ensure the correct stocks were set to automatically begin trading as markets opened across the globe on Monday morning. Satisfied that everything was in order, he took one last long look at the new London he had created before turning in for an early night's sleep. Come Monday, Vasily Andrenov would be an extremely rich man. Part 1. Escape. Chapter 1. Aboard the Bitter Harvest, Atlantic Ocean, November. There's a reason that recreational sailors don't cross the Atlantic as winter advances from the north. It's a rough ride. Lieutenant Commander James Rees found some amusement in the fact that as a naval officer he had minimal experience actually sailing a boat on the open water. The bad news was that the rough seas made the crossing both dangerous and physically exhausting. The good news was that the strong winds cut considerable time off the trip and lessened his chances of discovery. Within a few days of leaving Fisher's Island off the coast of Connecticut, Rees was getting the hang of sailing the 48-foot Beneteau Oceanus, christened Bitter Harvest by the family from whom he had liberated it. And the tasks of managing the yacht had become more or less routine. The boat's AIS transponder had been turned off by its owners to make him harder to find, if, in fact, anyone was looking for him in the mid-Atlantic, and he still had his Garmin 401 GPS that had been attached to the stock of his M4. He used it sparingly to conserve battery power, and in conjunction with the onboard charts and compass, he was able to track his progress. It wasn't perfect, but it gave him a good idea of his location and was better than trying to use the stars because of the frequent cloud cover. The yacht had a small nautical library aboard, along with a modern sextant, and Rees spent his downtime teaching himself a new skill. He didn't have a precise destination in mind, nor did he think he needed one. The terminal brain tumor he had recently been diagnosed with was sure to deliver him to the afterlife before long. Just a few months ago, Reese had been a troop commander leading an element from SEAL Team 7 on a mission in Afghanistan that ended in disaster. Reese and his team were deliberately sent into an ambush set by corrupt officials within his own chain of command. His men, and later his pregnant wife and daughter, were murdered to cover up the side effects of an experimental drug with a financial forecast that created a widespread conspiracy leading to the highest echelons of the Washington, D.C. power establishment. Those side effects were brain tumors, just like the one growing inside Reese. In revenge, he had embarked on a one-man mission of retribution that left a swath of bodies from coast to coast. Reese now found himself on the open ocean, a world away from the death and destruction he'd wrought on U.S. soil. The interior of the Bitter Harvest was intended for far more hands than Reese's solo crew, which left him plenty of room below decks. The boat was provisioned with massive stocks of food, which filled much of the galley and nearly the entire second stateroom. The scene reminded him of the few times he'd been on fast-attack submarines during training missions. Those boats could make their own clean air and water. Their only limitation was food. The submariners literally walked on top of their food stocks as they ate their way through the supplies. His 53-gallon fuel capacity was supplemented by plastic fuel containers strapped to the deck railing. Even so, Reese was careful to keep his consumption to a minimum. The wind howled topside, and Reese bundled in his warmest layers as he steered the vessel day and night. Even after studying the instructions, Reese had a hard time trusting the NKE Marine Electronics autopilot. It still required him to be on deck every 20 minutes, its manual reminding sailors that in fair conditions at 5 knots, one had 20 minutes to the horizon. What lay just beyond that was unknown. He wasn't sure how long he'd live, but he preferred not to die in the cold, so he took a southerly course toward Bermuda. The headaches came and went at random intervals, but for the lack of a good night's sleep, he still felt better than he had in some time. Alone, at sea, he couldn't help but reflect upon the past few months, the violent path that had led him to this relatively peaceful location in the Atlantic. The blanket of stars at night reminded him of his daughter Lucy, and the endless sea reminded him of Lauren. Lucy was fascinated with the night sky during the times they'd escaped the light pollution of Southern California, and Lauren had always loved the water. He tried to focus on the good times with the two people he loved most in this world, but with the joy of his memories came moments of unbearable pain. He was haunted by visions of their untimely and bloody deaths at the muzzle of an AK meant for him, set up by a financial and political machine that Reese had then dismantled piece by piece. With a tinge of guilt, he thought of Katie. Fate, or a divine force, had brought investigative journalist Katie Buranek into his life at precisely the right time to help him unravel the conspiracy that had led to the deaths of his team and family. They had endured a lot during their brief friendship, but it was how he had left her that tore at him, his last actions and words. He wondered if she understood, or if she saw him as a monster hell-bent on revenge with no regard for those left in his bloody wake. Brotherhood was an often used term in the teams, a concept that had been tested to its limits as Reese's life had come apart in the preceding months. He had lost his brothers in arms when his troop was ambushed on a dark Afghan mountain, and he'd been betrayed by one of his closest friends on the home front. With his troop and family dead, and with death whispering in his ear, Reese had become the insurgent he'd been fighting for the past 16 years. He had become his own enemy. Like any insurgent, he needed a safe haven in which to regroup, re-equip, and plan his next move. He needed to go back to his roots. His closest friend had recently come through when Reese needed him most, aiding Reese's escape from New York and inserting him on his over-the-beach mission onto Fisher's Island to kill the last conspirators on his list. Rafe Hastings hadn't hesitated when Reese requested assistance, risking everything for his former teammate without asking for anything in return. They'd met on the rugby pitch at the University of Montana in the fall of 1995, Reese playing outside center and Rafe as the number eight, by far the most skilled competitor on the team. Rugby was an obscure sport to most Americans in the early 1990s, so the community and the culture it fostered was a tight one. The running joke was that they were a drinking team with a rugby problem. A year ahead of Reese in school, Rafe had the serious demeanor of someone twice their age. The hint of an accent that Reese couldn't quite place suggested a history beyond the borders of North America. As Reese quickly tired of the traditional party scene associated with college life, he noted that Rafe spent his free time either studying wildlife management in the library or taking off alone in his Jeep Scrambler to explore the Montana backcountry. When Reese figured he had reached the point where his prowess on the pitch had earned him some time with the team captain, he decided to pry. At one of the famed rugby team parties at Rafe's off-campus house, Reese made his approach. "Beer?" Reese asked over the music, holding out a red Solo cup recently topped off from the keg outside. "No, I'm good, mate," Rafe responded, holding up a glass with what Reese assumed was whiskey. "Nice muley," Reese commented, nodding at a shoulder mount of a mule deer, measuring what Reese figured to be over 200 inches. "Ah, that was a great hunt. Bake the brakes. A wise old deer, that one." "Is that where you're from?" "Yeah. Winifred would be the closest town." "Incredible country up there, but it's not really known for its rugby. Where were you before that?" Rafe hesitated, took a sip of his drink, and replied, "Rhodesia." "Rhodesia? You mean Zimbabwe?" Rafe shook his head. "Can't bring myself to call it that." "Why is that?" "The Marxist government is stealing the farms that have been in families for generations. It's the reason we came to the U.S., but that was when I was just a kid." "Oh man, we don't hear much about that over here. My dad spent some time in Africa before I was born. He doesn't talk about it, but he had a book on the Selous Scouts on the shelf in his study that I read in high school. Those guys were hardcore." "You know about the Scouts?" Rafe looked up, surprised. "Yeah, my dad was in the military, a frogman in Vietnam. I've read about every military book on special operations I could get my hands on." "My dad was in the Scouts, back when I was young," Rafe offered. "We barely ever saw him until the war was over."
"Really?
Wow." "My dad was gone a lot, too. He went to work at the State Department after the Navy." Rafe looked at his younger teammate suspiciously. "You mentioned the muley. You a hunter?"
"I'd go out with my dad every chance we got."
"Well, we might as well do this right, then. Finish that beer," he said, pulling out a bottle of whiskey with a label Reese was unfamiliar with and pouring them both a couple of fingers.
"What should we drink to?" Reese asked.
"My dad would always say, 'To the lads,'" which was something from his time in the Scouts.
"Well, that's certainly good enough for me.
To the lads, then."
"To the lads,"
Rafe nodded.
"What is this?" Reese asked, surprised by how smoothly it had gone down.
"It's something my dad gave me before I drove down. Three Ships, it's called, from South Africa. I don't think you can get it here."
Encouraged by what seemed to be the start of a new friendship and by the lubrication of the whiskey, the normally stoic Rafe began talking about his upbringing in Africa, their farm in what was then Rhodesia, their move to South Africa after the war, and their eventual immigration to the United States.
"I'm headed out to Block 4 tomorrow morning early. I have an elk tag. You want to go?"
"I'm in," Reese responded without hesitation. The two were on the road at 04:30 the next morning. It became obvious to Reese that his rugby team captain was a serious hunter who pursued mule deer and elk with the same dedication that he applied in the classroom and on the pitch. Reese had never met anyone with Rafe's instincts for the natural world. It was as if he were part of it. As fall turned to winter, they would set out following class Thursday afternoons and hunt dawn to dusk, carrying their compound bows and minimalist camping gear on their backs. Rafe was always pushing farther from the trailhead, deeper into the timber, higher up the mountain. They would barely speak, so as not to disturb the heightened senses of their quarry, and were soon able to read each other's thoughts by body language, hand signals, and subtle changes in facial expression. During one of their trips that fall, Reese shot a massive bull elk at the bottom of a canyon at last light. It was Sunday evening, and they both had classes the next morning that could not be missed. They worked quickly to butcher the bull by headlamp and carried him out on their backs, their packs laden with nearly 100 pounds of meat per trip. It took them 3 hours to hike out of the bottom and back to the trailhead, where they hung the meat and headed back for more. They worked all night to recover the bull and hadn't had a second's sleep when they stumbled into class, their clothing caked with dried sweat and elk blood. Even in Montana, this drew strange looks from their professors and classmates. Their appearance that morning earned them the nickname the Blood Brothers, and the moniker stuck with them through the remainder of their college years. To store the massive amount of meat they'd packed out of the wilderness during the season, Rafe added an additional chest freezer to his garage. During colder days of winter, they honed the art of preparing wild game. Their beast feasts became potluck events, with fellow students bringing their own side items and desserts to accompany the elk tenderloin, deer roast, or duck breast that the Blood Brothers had painstakingly prepared. Reports of homemade liquor being served were never fully substantiated. Reese visited Rafe's family ranch outside Winifred that next spring and was amazed at the sprawling property. It wasn't over the top by any means, but it was obvious that the Hastingses had done well. It explained Rafe's Jeep and off-campus house. Mr. Hastings conveyed to Reese that he'd brought with him to Montana the techniques he'd learned ranching in Rhodesia. Back in Africa, they didn't always have the option to bid on expensive, well-bred cows at auction, and often found themselves nursing weak or even sick cattle back to health. While others in the Montana ranching community continued to pay high prices for registered cows at auction, only to be caught off guard when the market shifted, the Hastingses bought the less desirable cattle and built them up, in essence, buying low and selling high. When other ranchers had to sell parts of their property, the Hastingses were on solid financial ground and could purchase additional property at rock-bottom prices, not so much to run more cattle, but to diversify their assets. That newly acquired land allowed them to add hunting leases and operations to their portfolio, while those same lands appreciated in value. They built a solid reputation as a family that knew the business and knew the land. For the next 3 years, the Blood Brothers were inseparable, hunting in the fall, backcountry skiing in the winter, rock climbing and kayaking in the spring. It was during a visit with the Reese family in California that Rafe made the decision to join the Navy. His own father had instilled in him a deep sense of appreciation for their adopted country, and his family's military service in the Rhodesian Bush War made it seem like a mandatory family obligation. When Mr. Reese told him that SEAL training was some of the toughest ever devised by a modern military, Rafe made his decision to test himself in the crucible known as BUDS. The Blood Brothers' only separation was during the summers when Rafe would travel to work on the family farm in Zimbabwe. His father wanted him to maintain the connection with his roots, working for his uncle's hunting outfit back in the old country. Rafe felt most at home alongside the trackers, whose skill and instinct for reading animal signs bordered on supernatural With them, Rafe was able to hone his skills in the African wilderness and perfect his command of the local Shona language. Reese traveled to Zimbabwe during one college summer and spent a month working in the bush alongside his friend. They were the junior men in camp, and so their work wasn't very glamorous, changing tires, maintaining the safari trucks, helping in the skinning shed. Just before the final week of Reese's visit, Rafe's uncle approached them after a particularly hard day in the field. He handed them a piece of yellow legal paper. It was their leftover quota, animals that they were required to harvest by the biologists who managed the game in their conservancy, but that hadn't been hunted successfully by clients during the season. It was time for the boys from Montana to hunt and deliver the meat to the walk-in coolers that supplied food to the hundreds of workers employed by the Hastings' tobacco farming, cattle ranching, and safari operations.
"Take a cruiser and a tracker. You have the run of the place. Just down bugger it up, eh?"
Reese's reminiscing was broken by a cold breeze blowing across his face. He looked up to the sight of a front on the skyline moving rapidly in his direction. Was it a red sky this morning? Something about the look of this storm unnerved him. It might even be more powerful than the one he'd sailed through when his journey began. He put on his rain gear and made sure that everything on the deck was secure. He'd made a habit of wearing a safety line when topside, and he checked to ensure that it was connected at both ends. When it hit, he would lower the sails to ride out the storm, but for now he took a tack to take full advantage of the wind, then headed below to make coffee. This would be a long night. When the front hit, it did so with a vengeance. The cabin top kept the bulk of the rain out of the cockpit, but it was impossible to stay dry. Reese had lowered and stowed the sails to protect them from the ravaging winds, so the boat now moved under diesel power. An experienced sailor would be able to harness the power of the storm, but Reese didn't feel the risk was worth the potential speed reward. He wasn't worried so much about navigation at this point. His goal was to make it through the storm without sustaining any significant damage to the boat. He would figure out where he was if he survived. The sky had darkened, and the seas churned ferociously. Not being able to anticipate the next big wave was the most unnerving part. Reese couldn't help but remember his last time in rough seas years earlier, speeding toward a Class 3 tanker in the northern Arabian Gulf. It had been dark then, too, just after midnight as the combatant craft assault, driven by the experienced boat drivers of Special Boat Team 12, pursued their quarry while it made a beeline for Iranian waters. That was a few years back, and Reese had been surrounded by a team, by the best in the business. Now, he was all alone. Though his family lineage dated back to the Vikings of ancient Denmark, Reese decided if there had ever been a genetic aptitude for seafaring pursuits, it had certainly been diluted since the 9th century. Water washed steadily over the starboard bow, but the bilge pumps did their duty, and the bitter harvest stayed dry below decks. The boat bobbed like a toy in the maelstrom of wind and water. Reese's life totally at the mercy of the elements and the skill of the boat's builders. Even with a modern craft, the conditions were terrifying. Reese pictured his Nordic ancestors making such crossings in open wooden boats and decided that they were far more skilled than he. With his longish hair and beard soaked in rain and seawater, though, he didn't think he'd look too out of place on one of their longboats. He wondered what offering they would make at this moment to stay in the good graces of Aegir, the Norse sea deity fond of dragging men and their ships into the depths. Just when Reese was sure that the seas couldn't get any rougher, the storm dialed up its intensity. The craft surged upward as a flash of lightning illuminated the ocean, and for a split second Reese was sure it wasn't the tumor that was going to kill him. He was riding directly toward the crest of a wave that towered above the boat's mast. Like a roller coaster, the vessel paused at the peak of the wave before surging downward toward the black sea below. Rhys felt weightless as he gripped the stainless steel wheel with both hands and braced for impact, screaming an animal roar at the top of his lungs. All 30,000 pounds of the bitter harvest careened into the trough in a deafening crash, Rhys's body slamming into the wheel with the force of a driver in a head-on collision, knocking him into darkness. A cold wave washing over the gunwale shocked Rhys into consciousness. He found himself lying on the deck between the steering stations, his face throbbing from its meeting with the boat's wheel. His hand instinctively went to his face and came away wet with blood that washed translucent almost instantly in the downpour. His head was gashed open, and his nose felt broken, but he was alive. The boat's keel had held. Using the wheel to pull himself to his feet, he reclaimed his place at the helm. Blood ran into his eyes. Not that he could see much anyway. He focused on keeping the compass oriented south so he would pass through the storm as quickly as possible. Things didn't improve much, but they didn't seem to get worse. He hoped that the massive wave he'd ridden was the climax of the storm. Perhaps he was just adapting, but it seemed as though the weather was easing a bit. Over the next few hours, Rhys would wipe the blood from his eyes, check the heading, adjust the rigging, and wipe the blood away again. His nose throbbed, and the open wound on his forehead stung in the salty spray of the unforgiving Atlantic winds. Chapter 2. Save Valley, Zimbabwe, Africa, August 1998. Rhys had shot a very impressive kudu bull that morning, a spiral-horned antelope known by many as the Gray Ghost due to its elusiveness. He, Rafe, and the trackers had pursued the animal since dawn, and the old bull finally made the mistake of stopping to take a peek at whatever was tracking him. Loading the nearly 600-pound animal into the bed of the small pickup had been a challenge, but between the ingenuity of the trackers and the cruiser's winch, they had made it happen. They wore the carefree smiles of youth as they approached the ranch house. Rafe drove with Gona, the junior tracker, riding shotgun, while Rhys and the senior tracker rode in the high seat, welded to the bed of the truck, sipping beers and enjoying the beautiful countryside. As they turned the corner where the house came into view, Rafe could tell instantly that something wasn't right. Three battered pickup trucks were parked haphazardly on the manicured lawn of the main house, and a group of about a dozen men were scattered around the yard, most of them visibly armed. Rafe drove straight toward the trucks and stopped just short of the crowd. Feeling very exposed in the back of the truck, Rhys eyed the group, whose demeanor was clearly hostile, and wondered what was going on. He counted the men, taking note of how many were displaying weapons, and glanced down at the .375 H&H rifle sitting horizontally in the rack that ran just in front of his knees. The math wasn't good. Rafe said something to the intruders in Shona, but they ignored him. The trackers hunched down in their seats like scolded dogs, their eyes fixed on their feet. Rhys had learned to trust their judgment over the past month and decided that eye contact with their visitors was not a good idea. Their dress ranged from soccer jerseys to threadbare dress shirts. Their only uniform seemed to be a lack of uniformity. Most appeared to be in their teens or early 20s, and the weapons they carried were a mix of AKs, shotguns, machete-like pangas, and battered old hunting rifles. Rhys had no idea who these guys were, but he could tell that they weren't happy. After a few moments, Rafe's uncle emerged from the house, shadowed by a man roughly the same age. Unlike the others, this man was overweight and well-dressed. He wore Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses and a purple silk button-down shirt with short sleeves. A thick gold chain hung at his neck, and he sported what looked like crocodile skin loafers on his feet. His swollen fingers removed a half-smoked cigarette from his mouth, which he flicked aside before strolling slowly across the Hastings's veranda as if it were his own. Clearly this man was the boss. The younger men perked up when he appeared, their confidence and aggressiveness boosted. He was the alpha, and they were the pack. He strode directly toward the white pickup, with his gang falling in behind him. He ignored Reese and walked to the driver's side window, saying something in Shona that Reese couldn't understand. At Rafe's deliberate response in his native tongue, the fat man jerked a cocked and locked handgun from the back of his waistband. Reese's dad had the same one in his collection, a Browning high-power 9mm. He held the muzzle to Rafe's head with his finger resting lazily on the trigger. Reese glanced down at his rifle, knowing that he could never get to it in time. He had seldom felt so helpless in his life, and made up his mind that if Rafe were shot, his killer would die soon afterward. The man held the pistol for what seemed like an eternity, a gold bracelet dangling loosely from his sweaty wrist, the entire episode going into what felt like slow motion in Reese's mind. The tracker next to him murmured a hushed prayer, and Reese found himself wondering what religion he followed. Rafe's uncle stood 10 yards away, unable to act against these armed tormentors. Finally, the man leaned in close to Rafe's face, an evil glimmer in his eye, before whispering, "Pow!" as he raised the muzzle in feigned recoil. He laughed a deep-throated laugh, his belly shaking against his expensive shirt, turning to face his men. They responded with laughs of their own, and those who carried weapons fired shots of intimidation into the clear blue sky. He motioned them toward their vehicles with his handgun, and they all crowded quickly aboard, one man holding the passenger door for the boss to drag his considerable bulk into the seat. The truck's wheels spun as they accelerated away, tearing deep red ruts into the lawn. Rich Hastings shook his head as he cursed the armed rabble.
"Bloody bastards!"
Rafe opened the truck door and walked to his uncle's side, seemingly unfazed by his own brush with death.
"Who in the hell were they, Uncle Rich?"
"Wovitz."
He pronounced it as a single word.
"Wovitz? Those guys look too young to have even been born when the war ended."
"That's just what they call themselves. They have nothing to do with the war. Mugabe and his people keep up the revolutionary rhetoric, so no one notices they're stealing the country blind. They're a gang of thieves, plain and simple, extortionists."
"What do they want?"
"Money, of course. Eventually they'll want the whole farm, but right now they'll settle for a payoff. I'd love to shoot the bastards, but that's what the government is hoping for. They send these gangs out to harass the landowners, knowing that if we fight back, they can run to the international media with cries of colonialism. Besides, if I fight back, the army would seize this place by nightfall."
"What about the police?"
Reese chimed in, his American-born mind shocked at the injustice.
"The police? The police probably told them how to get here. Now, boys, there's not much we can do except pay their tribute and hang on as long as we can. I could move to the U.S. and go work for your father tomorrow, Rafe. But what would happen to this place? This farm has been in our family for 150 years. I'm not going to abandon it. We employ over 100 people here. You think those bastards are going to take care of them? We run our own school here, for Christ's sake."
As a 20-year-old, Reese wasn't sure what to think, though he did recognize he was from a vastly different culture. On one hand, you had indigenous people who had elected a leader viewed by much of the world as legitimate, though there were already rumblings about the disappearances and murders of those who opposed the now-entrenched dictator. On the other, you had the established property rights of families who had homesteaded their farms with the approval of the British Crown and lived on them legally for more than a century. Both sides believed that they were in the right, and neither was willing to budge. To the young American, it looked like conditions were ripe for war. Chapter 3 Aboard the Bitter Harvest, Atlantic Ocean, November. Reese was on the backside of the storm now, the seas having calmed from deadly to merely rough. He powered up the GPS and took note of his location. The storm had pushed him quite a bit south, which was good news, so he decided to put up the sails to conserve fuel. With things more or less under control, Reese set the analog autopilot and went below for the first time in what felt like days. He looked in the mirror and couldn't help but laugh at the disheveled figure that returned his gaze. The gash on his forehead had stopped bleeding, but probably needed stitches. A few butterflies would have to do. Both eye sockets were swollen from the broken nose and were on their way to turning black. His hair was soaked and hung well below his collar. He washed his face in the sink, wrung his hair out, and stripped down so that he could put on dry clothes. He dug through the medical supplies and found what he was looking for, bandages and ibuprofen. Hunger hit next. His food stocks would, in all likelihood, outlive him, but he was already growing tired of frozen and canned food. Reese opened a Tupperware container of Oreos and stuffed two into his mouth for a quick sugar fix. He couldn't muster the energy to do any serious cooking, so he grabbed a bag of ramen noodles and nuked them in the microwave. Shoving a forkful of noodles down his throat was an action that he regretted instantly. The hot food seared the roof of his mouth, and he exhaled several quick breaths in an attempt to cool the scorching sustenance. He poked around the bowl with his fork, his exhausted brain debating between satisfying his hunger and the fear of burning his mouth again. Hunger won out, and he blew furiously on a second bite before placing it gingerly on his tongue. By the time the noodles had cooled to a palatable temperature, the bowl was empty. Reese drank some water and went back topside to give things a look. Satisfied that all was as it should be, he set the timer on his watch for 2 hours and fell face first onto the bed in the main stateroom. Reese was steering the boat on a calm sea as Lauren sunned herself on the deck, a precious moment of relaxation for the busy mother of a 3-year-old. He took in the increasingly rare family time with a smile, consciously aware of his happiness in the moment. Lucy sat on Reese's lap and helped steer, taking serious interest in the letters on the floating compass.
"S is for Sissy,"
Lucy announced, referring to her pet name for her maternal grandmother. "That's right, pretty girl, you're so smart. What starts with an E?"
"Elmo."
"That's right, Lucy."
"What's that, Daddy?"
"What, baby?" Reese turned his head to see what his daughter was pointing at off the stern. A massive wave crested above the sailboat, as if in slow motion. Reese yelled for Lauren to hold on, but he couldn't make her hear him. The rogue wave crashed over the stern, swamping the boat and tearing Lucy from his grasp. She looked pleadingly into his eyes as she reached for his outstretched hand, the water dragging her ever farther away. He kicked his legs, but it was like running in wet concrete. Gasping for breath and redemption, with seawater filling his lungs, he descended into the depths, away from his family, away from life. A horrible beeping sound grew louder and louder, jolting Reese awake. He sat up, drenched in sweat, blinking his eyes and looking at the unfamiliar surroundings. It took him a few moments to get his bearings. He swung his feet to the floor and ran the fingers of both hands through his hair.
"It won't be long, girls. I'll be with you soon. Maybe today."
He fished around with his feet until they found his flip-flops. Then he stood and stretched until his hands hit the ceiling. He walked slowly through the galley and salon, grabbing his sunglasses from a table, before heading up to the deck to face his demons. Chapter 4 Al-Hasaka, Syria, November. Rojava, better known as the Democratic Federation of Northern Syria, occupied the northwestern corner of the embattled nation. This multi-ethnic confederation had seceded from the central government with relative success and operated as an autonomous nation with its own constitution. After expelling ISIS, known there as Daesh, from the area, the local residents and refugees from the south enjoyed reasonable living conditions. In Rojava, equal rights for both genders, freedom of religion, and individual property rights were all enshrined in the founding document. These principles of secular democracy had united Arabs, Kurds, and Turks into relative peace and stability, and had the potential to spread across the rest of Syria. To most, this would seem to be good progress. To others, it was a threat to their power. The Interior Ministry of Syria had dispatched a sniper named Nizar Khatan to cut the head off the snake. The Federation and its nearly 5 million residents were led by co-presidents, an Arab, Masur Haddad, and a female Kurd, Hediye Fatah. Nizar was not a particularly devout Muslim, but he was an Arab, and found the concept of a woman running a nation offensive. However, given the freedom to choose which of the co-presidents to target, Nizar decided upon the male. As much as he would love to teach this Kurd bitch a lesson, leaving a woman in charge would actually help unravel this little fiefdom even more. President Haddad's home sat in one of the better neighborhoods of Al-Hasaka, a large city that sat geographically near the nation's borders with both Turkey and Iraq. Hasaka was urban, crowded, and flat, making a long-range shot difficult to plan and execute. Though taking out the target at close range would make Nizar's escape more difficult, he'd planned for that contingency. He had examined the aerial photographs as well as the intelligence provided by regime assets operating in the city, but he could not locate an appropriate hide site. One of the older men in his unit mentioned a technique used by the DC snipers, a pair of criminals who had terrorized the American's capital city over a period of weeks just a year after 9/11. Nizar was too young to have remembered the attacks, but an online article gave him all the inspiration he needed to create his own rolling hide. The battered white Kia Frontier truck looked to be of similar vintage as most of the other vehicles parked on the street, and local plates had been secured so as not to arouse any suspicion from the Asayish, the local security forces. The truck's bed was piled with building materials covered by a plastic tarp and so looked like one of the many vehicles connected with a nearby construction site. Just after 9 o'clock p.m., Nizar pulled the truck up against the curb, with the bed facing the target's home. The street was deserted, but he went through the motions of pretending to look for something among the concrete blocks and lumber in the back of the truck, ultimately crawling into the hollow space he'd built and pulling a block into place behind him. He wasn't a tall man, but Nizar wished that the truck bed had been longer when he had to bend his knees to fit into the space. The night air was cool. He pulled up a woolen blanket, adding warmth and an additional layer of concealment to his prone form. Nizar had dozed off on a thin foam mattress but was jolted awake by the sensation of the truck's movement. The Kia bounced on its worn shocks as someone pushed down on the rear bumper. He heard the rustling of the tarp and the scraping sound of blocks being moved against one another. His heart began to race, his hand finding the plastic pistol grip of his rifle.
"Am I compromised?"
He slowly moved the selector switch to semi-auto, making far more noise than he'd hoped, but whoever it was didn't seem to notice as the scraping of the concrete continued. The blocks were a facade stacked on top of wooden slats just above Nizar's head, and removing one or two would surely reveal his position. In a matter of seconds, his mission could be over.
"What are you doing?"
an authoritative voice cried out in Arabic from what sounded like 10 or 20 meters away. The movement of the blocks came to an abrupt halt.
"I am just looking at these blocks. These are good blocks," the nearby man responded. "Those blocks are not yours, old man. Get away from that truck before I have to arrest you."
"I was only looking."
Nizar felt the man step down from the bumper.
"I am sorry, sir."
"Go now."
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
Nizar could hear the man scurry away on sandaled feet. Heavier steps approached, and a bright light blazed through the cracks between the blocks. Nizar put his head down and closed his eyes, not even daring to breathe, hiding from the police officer's flashlight like a child under sheets. The seconds ticked by slowly before he heard the light click off, and, after a pause, the boots moved away. The sniper audibly exhaled. No more sleep would come this night. His thoughts wandered to memories from his youth, his father teaching him the virtue of patience under the thin metal roof of their family's farmhouse. Their perch in the loft was not much different than this one, cramped and dank but comfortable on a cushion of hay. The muted form of the golden jackal circled the goat's pen, but Nizar couldn't see the sights in the pre-dawn light. The old British rifle felt huge in his hands, and his neck craned forward uncomfortably due to the length of the stock. He could hold it only by resting the long wooden forend on a rolled-up blanket. He could smell the tobacco on his father's breath as he whispered to him to stay calm. Nizar shook with excitement, but his father's voice slowed his breathing and steadied the tremor of the iron sights. When the jackal circled again, the gray light had turned pink, and he could make out the rectangular post through the rear notch. His father's repeated words became almost a hum as he began to squeeze the World War I rifle's heavy trigger. Calm. As dawn broke, the city began to come alive. Engines coughed, dogs barked, birds chirped, and children shrieked with laughter. Even during war, life went on. Among the many sounds of urban life, one stood out for Nizar: the ringing of church bells. Al-Hasakah was home to Christian churches as well as mosques, and, instead of the call to morning prayer echoing from a minaret tower, the bells of the Syrian Orthodox Church clanged in the distance. Under the cover of darkness, Nizar had rotated the concrete block in front of him so that he could see through the hollow end. He had broken the center section out so that neither his suppressed muzzle nor scope would be obstructed. He observed the increasingly bright area around Haddad's front door through the 4x magnification of the Russian PSO-1 scope mounted to the side of his VSK-94 rifle. It was an ugly black thing that looked like the stepchild of the ubiquitous AK-47, with half a meter of tubular suppressor in the front and a boxy stock to the rear. Nizar cared nothing about its odd looks. Instead, he found beauty in its function. The home was surprisingly modest. The one-story structure was surrounded by a low stone wall topped with an iron fence that extended 8 feet above street level. There was no sign of guards, armed or otherwise, though Nizar assumed that the gate was at least locked. The sloping range estimator engraved into the scope's reticle allowed the user to bracket a man's height and establish an approximate distance to the target. No one moved within Nizar's field of view, but he could see the front door, which he used for the same purpose, taking into account that the door aperture would be slightly taller than the average male figure for which the reticle was calibrated. The range was just over 100 meters, which was an incredibly short shot for a sniper of Nizar's talents, particularly from this stable shooting position. This rifle and its cartridge were engineered for maximum stealth, the suppressor masking the report of the shot and the bullet flying at less than the speed of sound, so as not to create a sonic crack on its way to the target. As a result, the 16.8-gram subsonic bullet dropped like a rock, which made knowing the range to the objective critical. Nizar had to piss, but he dared not move, since the target could appear at any moment. He hadn't come this far to be caught with his dick in his hand. With the rising sun came the encroaching heat, violating his confined space, his cloth headscarf quickly soaking through, sweat stinging his eyes. The waiting was always uncomfortable, but that was the job of a sniper. Chapter 5. Aboard the Bitter Harvest, Atlantic Ocean, November. The days following the storm allowed Rhys time to think. One beautiful sunrise followed another as he sailed onward. The headaches he knew would eventually kill him came and went. They felt like a million small shards of glass grinding together inside his brain. There was no rhyme or reason to when they would hit, so there was nothing Rhys could do to prevent them. He thought of his family, his beautiful wife and daughter. He thought of all those who had helped him over the preceding months in his quest for vengeance, particularly his friends Marco del Toro and Liz Riley. He hoped they were okay. He thought of Katie and his last words to her. And he thought of Rafe Hastings. During his last year of college, Rafe began looking seriously into fulfilling his dream of becoming a SEAL. Rhys still had another year of school, but trained hard with his friend to get him ready for the rigors ahead. Rafe's father was a bit hesitant about the prospect of his only son following in his footsteps to life as a commando, and gave his blessing on the condition that he start in the enlisted ranks before becoming a commissioned officer. Rhys decided to go the enlisted route a year later, as he wanted to focus on building his tactical skills before assuming a leadership role. In today's Navy, there are programs that allow aspiring SEALs to enlist with the specific purpose of attending BUDS, the brutal 6-month selection and training program with 80% attrition. Things were different in the late 1990s. SEAL recruits would attend basic training at Great Lakes, Illinois, before attending an A school, which Rhys always thought stood for Apprentice School, before going to BUDS. Rhys's enlisted rate was Intelligence Specialist. His 16 weeks of training took place in Virginia following boot camp. He had to complete the school for a job that he never intended to do before he could even attempt to become a SEAL. The thinking from senior-level military bureaucrats was that if only 20% were going to graduate BUDS, they had better train up the other 80% ahead of time in occupational specialties needed by the Big Blue Navy. The result was that Rhys and Rafe took similar paths, but were separated by a year. Rhys arrived at Coronado to begin BUDS just as Rafe was completing his SEAL qualification training course, and he was able to attend his friend's graduation. As he watched the man whom he considered a brother shake hands with the commanding officer, he knew that he wouldn't quit until he too was standing at that ceremony. If the instructors didn't want him to become a SEAL, they were going to have to kill him. After the stories they had heard from Rhys's dad about the SEAL teams in Vietnam, Rhys and Rafe both thought they would be off on secret missions as soon as they crossed the quarter decks into their first teams. The reality was different. No secret missions to hunt down terrorist leaders and rescue hostages. This was peacetime, and peacetime meant a lot of training. That, they quickly discovered, was their job, to train, to be prepared, to always be ready for the call. Then, on a sunny Tuesday morning in September 2001, that call came in. Rafe had made it through the vaunted Green Team and had multiple deployments under his belt as an assaulter at Naval Special Warfare Development Group when a Master Chief convinced him to become an officer. That meant attending Officer Candidate School, OCS, at Naval Station Newport, Rhode Island, where the Navy turned civilian candidates and enlisted sailors into butter bar ensigns in a matter of weeks, expertise in folding underwear and T-shirts somehow qualifying one to lead men into battle. Rhys had spent a few years in the enlisted ranks learning the trade, gaining tactical experience, and earning a reputation as one of the most competent snipers in the teams before going to officer candidate school, mostly due to Rafe's influence. It took a few years for their paths to realign, and when they did, they found themselves on the same battlefield during the height of the war as platoon commanders in a SEAL task unit in Ramadi, Iraq. The fighting was hot and dirty that summer as a civil war erupted across Iraq. The Sunni-Shia rift that traced its roots back to the death of the Prophet Muhammad in AD 632 was playing out in its modern incarnation. Throw in Al-Qaeda in Iraq, tribal loyalties, Iranian influence, and a dysfunctional government propped up by a foreign military and political machine, and you had all the ingredients for a caustic cocktail of violence. When their task unit lost two men to a roadside bomb, they pulled out all the stops to dismantle the threat network, eventually finding the cell leader, Hakim al-Maliki, through a tactical human collection effort that Rafe spearheaded. Just prior to launch, a mission to capture, kill the cell leader responsible for the deaths of their teammates was called off by senior-level military leaders. The Blood Brothers dug until they found out that al-Maliki was a CIA asset, part of a long-term deep penetration program of AQI. The agency wanted him alive and working his way up to a position that would give them actionable intelligence on Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the radical jihadist leader who rose to prominence as the leader of AQI after the U.S. invasion of Iraq and was currently public enemy number one. Feeling responsible for the deaths of his teammates and knowing where the CIA-protected cell leader would be for the next two nights, Rafe went off the reservation. He used the tactical human network to deliver a package to the AQI safehouse. That package mirrored the IED profile common in Ramadi at the time, a backpack containing a device consisting of a fertilizer-based main charge with commercial detonators from Pakistan sent Hakim al-Maliki to his 72 virgins. When the CIA accused him of taking out their prized asset, Rafe neither confirmed nor denied it. The CIA wanted him prosecuted for murder. They put the screws to the one officer rumored to have been in the source meeting where details of the assassination were discussed. But James Rhys didn't say a word that could help convict his friend. Without Rhys's testimony, there wasn't enough evidence to take Rafe to court-martial, and doing so would have exposed CIA sources and methods that they preferred to keep quiet. But to appease what had by that time become known as the interagency, Rafe was removed from the country, pending the outcome of an official investigation. He was sick of seeing his men die in what he saw as a war without end due to the blunders and missteps of senior military and political leaders. Tired of a bureaucracy that tied their hands with absurd rules of engagement and a system that, as Lieutenant Colonel Paul Yingling famously noted, imposed harsher punishments on privates who lost rifles than on generals who lost wars, Rafe didn't look back. He left the SEAL side of his life behind and dropped off the radar. He saw the birds first. You wouldn't expect to see a massive clump of birds out in the middle of the ocean, but here they were. They circled and dove like a flight of Stukas, scores of them. Anglers paid tens of thousands of dollars in sophisticated marine electronics to locate bird activity of this kind. Stumbling upon it blind was more than a bit of luck. The turbulence on the water was visible from hundreds of yards away, and Rhys jumped to the wheel, steering toward it. Dashing below, he retrieved a rod stowed in clamps on the ceiling of the boat's salon. As he approached the churning water, he jerked the main line to leave the sail flapping in the breeze, the boat's progress creeping to a mere drift. From the bow, Reese bent backward before snapping the rod forward over his shoulder, flinging the free-spooling Rapala into the wad of baitfish.
Good cast.
Flipping the bale back over on the big pen, he began to reel briskly with his rod tip pointed toward the top water frenzy. It took 30 seconds to reel the lure all the way back to the boat, and he quickly made a second cast. The line snapped taut and nearly jerked the rod out of his hands, and Reese eased back on the drag so as not to break the line. He let the fish take it, not being able to power the boat in its direction to take up any slack. Reese could almost hear his father coaching him through it.
"Let him get tired, son. Just be patient."
This reel held a ton of line, so he let the fish wear itself out, stripping most of it. When the fish turned or otherwise gave him a chance, Reese pumped the rod upward and reeled as he let the tip down. This dance lasted for at least a half hour, the fish stripping line, Reese fighting it back with increasing force. The muscles in his arms and shoulders burned, and his lower back ached, but he could sense his quarry's exhaustion. He couldn't help but think of Hemingway in his current plight.
"You are killing me, fish."
Reese reeled harder as the fish began to give up ground, bringing him closer to both the boat and the surface. He saw a flash of silver as the fish streaked by the bow, the sight of the white hull sending it surging away.
"Nice tuna."
He walked slowly toward the transom as he reeled, bringing the line to a position where he could land his catch. Holding the rod in his left hand, he worked with his right hand to lower the folding swim platform. Stepping onto the teak decking, he felt the cold ocean waves splash onto his bare feet. He didn't want to fall in, but if he did, at least the boat wasn't moving. 10 more minutes passed as he fought the tuna. At this point, he was pumping and reeling aggressively to capitalize on the fish's fatigue. He reached with one hand to grab the gaff, his wet hand slipping as he worked to remove the rubber tubing that was protecting the razor-sharp hook.
"This sure would be easier with two people."
When the thick monofilament leader broke the surface of the water, he reached up and grabbed it, wrapping it in loops around his left hand. He swung the gaff hard and missed, cursing himself. The fish swung around in a small circle, and he swung again, burying the hook into its shining flesh. He jerked upward and fell backward in one motion, dragging the 80- or 90-pound fish onto the swim platform. With one hand on the leader and one on the gaff, he hoisted the flapping yellowfin up onto the aft deck between the two steering wheels. He held on to the leader and gaff like a man possessed, determined not to let this fresh source of protein fall back into the sea. The tuna writhed and gasped, then went still, seemingly as exhausted as the mariner foe who landed him, its massive unblinking eye staring skyward. Grabbing a towel that was hanging on the rail to dry, Reese threw it over the fish, covering its eyes to prevent it from finding the